This podcast contains content that may be disturbing to some listeners. Check the episode description for more details and resources. And please, take care of yourself. Dear Kate, I don't know where to start with this letter. It is you that I have the most history with. 35 years worth of fighting and loving and crying, both to you and because of you. That is why I saved this letter for last, hoping inspiration would strike in the words I wrote to Talia or Krishna or Avery. I suppose that letters choose where to start, though, if you write them the way they're supposed to be written. This one starts with your name. You asked me once to call you Mom. I was 20 and I had already been calling you Kate for 10 or so years. It was soon after your divorce to my and Aaron's father. He left you with no income and mounting debt and phone calls from the banks. When you consulted a lawyer, she told you to change your phone number. You did, but they still called. I learned this too early, in your room in the old house in Ditmas Park. You cried to me and I handed you tissues on your bed. A friend commented to me just a few years ago that I seemed like your mother, not your daughter. She meant it as a joke after I told her about us coming back from California. It was right before Zora and I were to start fostering Marina, and we decided to take one last trip together before motherhood rendered me homebound. Or rather, I had a conference in San Francisco, and you decided that you wanted to come along. Your exact words, in fact, were,
"Maybe I'll come."
Do you mean, can I come? You thought about it, as though you hadn't considered that I might want to go on a work trip without my mother. In the end, you came anyway, upgrading what would have been an Airbnb to a Marriott and paying for meals you shouldn't have splurged on. I sound ungrateful. And maybe I am. Honestly, I am torn between thankful and fearful when I think of you with money. You're always willing to give, and I love that about you, but I also know that your status as a single mother and elementary school teacher haven't quite squashed the habits from your childhood of wealth. The comment from my friend came when I mentioned the flights. You, anxious, fidgeting, and asking me if I thought we would make our connecting flight. Me, exasperated and not wanting to appear as though I didn't want you there with me, handing you my phone to play games on the way down. My friend compared you to her own daughter, who has trouble sitting through long car rides without her mother's iPad. It's clear to me that the women in our family have never been prepared to be mothers. Not my great-grandmother, who spent my grandmother's childhood reeling from the losses of the Holocaust. Not my grandmother, your mother, who wanted more than anything to travel. Her dreams came to a halt as an 18-year-old girl when she met your father in New York, a handsome man, 5 years her senior, with whom she fell in love. She got married young and had you and your sister, born to a mother who would always regret her title. But you always wanted children, even if you weren't prepared to raise them on your own. You married my father, a lawyer with anger management problems and a history of abuse and alcoholism, and even when you were together, you were essentially a single mom. Did Aaron ever tell you how much he wanted our father's blue eyes, even though he was adopted? He used to complain about his. Too brown. I told him he would have looked dumb with blue eyes. You didn't know what to do with me. I wouldn't leave the house unless I could only wear one shoe. Something therapists later theorized was OCD related, though they weren't sure how. When Aaron finally came home, I bit him. And then Aaron turned out to be even more of a terror than I had been. If I wouldn't let him sit in my chair, he would punch and bite me until I relented. When we adopted a cat, a brown and white tabby with particularly fluffy ears and a stub of a tail, Aaron would sit on her and pull her ears. Once, he went on a rampage, kicking and hitting me until you locked me in your bedroom with you. Aaron pounded on the door outside, surprisingly thunderous bangs for such small fists, until he exhausted himself and retreated to his own room down the hall. No one thought until later that he had been imitating our father. When Aaron and I get together now, we are the ultimate team. For so long, I hated the way he followed me around, but he was also my consistent playmate and my best friend. I was 6 or 7 when we decided I would cut his hair. You found us with Aaron's hair on the floor in pieces and interrupted my work in progress. I remember how he looked like a balding man stuck in a child's body. Once, Aaron and I were playing frisbee in the house when I missed him. I have never and will never play a sport outside of a high school gym, and hit the big window in the living room instead. It shattered, cracks coming together like a spider web. When you heard the noise and found us, you sighed and said,
"Well, we needed a new window anyway."
We never spoke about it after that. You've complained more than once that Aaron and I gang up on you when we're together, that we're unfair. You have asked me if I'm Aaron's lawyer, but never asked me why I feel like I need to be. Do you remember when Aaron was thinking about coming back north after school? It was his senior year at Charlotte, and he was looking to be in Massachusetts or New Jersey, mostly for the seasons. You were still on his case for getting a degree in music over business. I reminded you that just because you regretted not majoring in business didn't mean Aaron would too. You didn't like that. Still, you've singled me out in ways that you would never do to Aaron. When you tell me you hate my hair, or that you love my hair but it could look so much better shorter, or that you love this haircut because the other one looked terrible, or else you beg me to wax my eyebrows even when I say I like the way they look. Aaron tried to talk to you about that, I know. Mostly now, you talk about my body when he's not around. Food too. It's something we touch on often in ways that remind me of how I once viewed my body as the enemy. You tell me I'm too thin and then talk about how fat you look in a photo. You comment on how well I've eaten and then go to the gym after eating too much. You aren't the reason my relationship with my body grew so tumultuous, but you didn't help either. When I tell you this, you scoff and tell me I should go back to therapy. Aaron has asked you to stop talking about food too, but you haven't listened. It's a pattern, I think, for you. To view women as something that needs to be fixed, or else a threat. You and your sister were close once until you weren't. You never met her kids until last year when her son reached out to you. You told me that you didn't want to meet her daughter, afraid that, in your words, she would be a bitch. I asked you why you didn't think that about your nephew, and you said you didn't know. But I can't help but wonder how different our relationship would be if I were a man, or how that will change your relationship with my daughter. The first time you saw her, Marina was 3 years old. Zora and I had officially adopted her a week earlier, with promises to call her birth mom, something you heartedly disapproved of, and two wide smiles that promised to split our faces. For the year and a half leading up to the adoption, when Zora and I were foster parents, you constantly asked me if I was sure I wanted to be a mother, even though I had taken every step to ensure that this time a woman in our family would be prepared for what came after. When we brought her home for forever, I asked you if you wanted to meet her, and you did. Then you asked me again if I knew what I was doing and if the adoption really was permanent. After 30 years of knowing you, of hating you, of loving you, I should have been prepared. An invisible shield at the ready to repel your words. But I wasn't. And they nearly knocked me down with their force. Nearly. My daughter is 6 now, and you hadn't seen her in 3 years before I decided Marina could handle it. And that I could handle it too. You kept asking, but I kept making excuses. I wasn't sure I could handle another battle with your insecurities about my own being. Not speaking with you, not letting you be a part of my own daughter's life, those were not decisions I made lightly. I spent nights crying about what I'd done, but honestly, I don't regret it. Your words already planted seeds of doubt in my own mind. You made me feel small, less than human. Even now that we are speaking again, I try to maintain some distance for my own well-being. I told Aaron about my therapist's assignment to write these letters. He asked me if I would write one to you. The funny thing is, I think this letter would come as a surprise to you. I don't know that you think of us as complicated, or that you see my antagonism as mutual. I see myself more clearly now than I have. My physical being as well as just me. But when I try to picture myself through your eyes, I see someone unfit to be Marina's mother. To be Zora's wife. To be your daughter. These are the things I need to overcome to feel at home in my skin. Kate, I love you. I have never not. I need you to know that. Even if parts of this letter will hurt. Even if I can picture you reading this letter in my mind, with your eyebrows scrunched together in confusion and your mouth trembling in frustration. It would be too much, and I know that. Part of me still wants to protect you from that. To be your mother, as I've already been told I am in an offhand comment. Our relationship is complicated. But it's my most important, and that matters. All my love, Sadie.